In today's time travel escapade, we journey into a movie unmistakably made in the year 1980 and attempt to find out what it takes for a man to fall in love with an oil painting in Somewhere in Time. If you haven't grown to love the song yet,
you suck.
And you will. Right now, you suck and you will. We're back, everybody, for episode 2 of the Time Travel series.
Numero dos. Yeah. Going international.
Are we?
No, dude. We haven't even gone out of the city.
No. I'm pretty sure. They don't even go out of the hotel in this movie. It's so local.
No.
This is a very different movie than H2L's The Time Machine.
He goes places.
Yeah.
And it's not a very good movie, but he be going places.
Yeah, and I mean, you got Morlock fights, which if you're falling asleep, you wake up and you're like, oh man, I'm awake now.
Yeah,
this movie is called Somewhere in Time.
Whew.
This is a
Travis. Different. How do we give a nutshell of what this episode's going to be about?
This is a different genre of film altogether.
Yeah,
it's time travel,
right?
But it's just the early 80s soft focus goodness, man.
Yeah. Or goodness, huh? Okay.
Or badness.
It's Ness.
We'll get into our experience with the movie, and I think previous experience is kind of important on this one.
Oh, yeah.
And also what the heck we witnessed when we saw it together. We watched this one together, folks.
On the big screen.
On the big screen. The medium-sized screen. But before we do that, we'll do a little what we watched this week.
Hey, Mr. Trabman.
Yeah.
Hey, what'd you watch this week, my brother?
I watched something that you talked about. Oh, geez. This was like Great Expectations ago.
Okay.
This was a few episodes back, but I finally got around to seeing Raya and the Last Dragon.
Dragon?
I'm sorry. Raya and the Last Flying Mythical Creature.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, Raya and the Last Dragon with the kid. I took her to the movie theater.
Yeah.
She wanted to go to the movie theater. This is like
this
is either this or the Spirit Horse movie that's out right now.
Is that a re-release or is
it? It's a new movie based on that show called Spirit, which is just a kid's cartoon about horse people.
Horse people?
People with horses.
Just like BoJack?
It sounds way better. It's centaurs. No. Anyway, the Spirit movie didn't look good, and Ryan the Last Dragon was what she wanted to see. So we saw it, and I don't have a lot to add to your amazing. If you want a rundown of Ryan the Last Dragon, please go back to the Great Expectations episode, because Justin does a masterful job of the entire plot in, like, I don't know, it's like 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And man, you got into it.
I did.
Your BPMs were off the charts.
They were going, man. There was a lot of dragons to discuss.
Yeah.
Let me tell you.
A lot of dragons that you don't understand by the end, that don't make a lot of sense.
No. And you know, let's tie the knot between that movie and Somewhere in Time.
Please.
There's things that we do in movies.
Yes.
So much money is put into movies, right?
Right.
And I'll concede it's a movie, you're suspending your disbelief. There's some things that don't matter. And
Absolutely.
It's like, hey, I didn't get an answer to that. It might not matter for
don't
the movie.
Don't care. Yep.
But for Raya and the Last Dragon and for Somewhere in Time, you can't invent entire paradoxes and then just be like, it's okay. Just go with it.
Movie's over. Yeah.
Don't you owe a little bit to your audience?
Yeah.
Right? Because like Raya and the Last Dragon is like, how do we save the world?
Yeah.
And the answer is like, magic?
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't even mean magic in the sense that, like, hey, Merlin said, if you take the sword from the stone, you're king.
Right.
You know, it's like...
It's like Disney, the power of love magic.
Right.
That's it.
Just creates a gazillion dragons in that movie.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I do love dragons. Okay, I just want to know where they come from.
Yeah. Right. It suffers from, like, being what is so obviously a lower tier Disney movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the animation's well done and they've got some big names in there. And,
yeah.
But other than that, like it does not feel like top shelf Disney story material.
No.
And it shows.
Scraping the dregs.
The dregs. Yeah.
Dragon dregs.
The dregs.
The very bottom of the scales.
The scaly under toe.
Yep. Can't say it any better than that, folks.
It's fine. You know, your kid might like it, but
right. But they will also forget it.
They will forget it, and you will walk away with many questions,
yeah.
Which I think is the perfect segue into our film for today. I don't have anything else to say about Ryan the Last Dragon.
Yeah, well, we could talk. I could talk a long time about dragons, but yeah. we owe it to the listeners, all three of them.
Yep.
We got to get into Somewhere in Time.
We do, and for our time travel series, that begins in a section we call...
Getting Jiggy with the Gigawatts!
How many times have we been here?
Would you believe me if I told you I was sent here from the future?
I want to know when and where you sent him.
What, you think I keep like a logbook?
Target vector, July 16, 1969.
All right, and as we said, this is a different kind. This is not like action-adventure... Yep. This is not comedy,
nope.
Which almost all the rest of the movies we have fall into like something. Maybe not 12 Monkeys. We'll see about that. But this is a romantic drama.
This is a melodrama.
This is hard melodrama.
Hardcore. Like, it should have a different rating.
It should be rated double MR.
M squared.
Melodrama. Radioactive. For radioactive melodrama. This is a movie that stars the one and only Christopher Reeve, who everybody knows as Superman from the original Richard Donner films. Rest in peace, Richard Donner.
But not Christopher Reeve?
Well, him too. Okay. It's just Richard Donner died like last week at the time of recording.
I see. You're an ageist.
Yep. Jane Seymour is the romantic love interest, the other lead in the movie, for sure. Yeah. And then on the poster and in the movie, but definitely one of those marketing moves, I feel like, Christopher Plummer, right?
Right.
He's in it, but if there's an antagonist, and I don't really think this movie needs one, right?
No.
He's the antagonist. Directed by an interesting director that we were doing some research on before we recorded.
Yeah.
Can't say the name, but the first name is Jeannot.
Schwarzenblagen.
Yeah. Anyway, this dude directed a ton, a lot of TV, a lot of procedural stuff that like shows you've heard of, all the cop procedurals.
Criminal Minds.
Yeah, all those kinds of things. He also did Jaws 2, which is a big budget, you know, studio movie, but not
great.
Super well reviewed. It's not the worst Jaws movie. By a stretch.
Yeah, true.
But accomplished enough. Did plenty of movies, plenty of TV. This was kind of the first third of his career because he's still directing today, TV and whatnot. And this was written by our buddy.
Our buddy, Michael Winterbottom.
Richard Matheson, right? Wrote the novel that this is based on, and he wrote the screenplay. And Justin, why do we sometimes love Richard Matheson?
We love Richard Matheson because he is... one of the chief writers, or the chief writer, I think, in on the Twilight Zone, the original series, that was not Rod Serling.
That's right. And he did like 17 episodes?
I don't remember the exact number.
Which is a lot for someone not named Rod Serling.
Right, exactly.
Rod Serling had total creative control and didn't bring a lot of writers in for the heck of it.
Right.
So Richard Matheson did some episodes that you've probably seen and heard of. This, in a way... falls into a mold, right? Like
it feels like a Twilight Zone episode sometimes.
The premise
is Twilight Zone-y, and this is actually written, he adapted his own novel into a screenplay. And
puzzling moves made in that department. Right?
Yeah, once we kind of get over the summation of the plot, it's kind of, I don't really understand why changes were made.
Yeah, it's his material.
It would have, and he changed it. I mean, allegedly, right? I guess the studio could have been like, here's a note.
Yeah.
Do this. It's dumb.
And right, like, right, right.
Okay. It's a weird juxtaposition because he is a guy that we know can write.
Sure.
And can write compelling these
short form, good stuff, right?
This movie is stretched to the outer limits of not just believability, but of
pacing and story and everything stretched tighter than a drum here.
This is the slowest movie without slow-mo.
Yeah, well, people are doing real-time slow-mo in this movie. Like, they're moving in slow-mo without any help from the camera or editor.
Just going in for the world's longest prelude to a kiss.
That we're going to talk about that for 17 minutes.
Good. That's how long the kiss took.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the backdrop. It's a romantic drama. It stars Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, Christopher Reeve was just getting into becoming a big name. This comes post Superman 1 and in the same year Superman 2. So he's becoming this household name as the face of that franchise. Jane Seymour had done a ton of TV and a lot of B movies. So plenty of work under her belt. I don't know about this big of a picture at this time because it's a little bit more high profile.
Yeah.
Made a bunch of money. And as some more backdrop to this, I think, Justin, it's important to bring up not just the background to the movie, but like this movie, much like we can look at today, we're going to get to Avengers Endgame. We've referenced Marvel on countless occasions. There's an entire culture and subculture built around that universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We have Comic-Con. We have all kinds of crazy message boards and that kind of stuff.
Right.
This movie has that.
It has that circa 1990.
Yes.
When nobody except comics was doing that. And that was hardcore nerd stuff in 1990.
It wasn't cool to be a nerd.
No.
When Comic-Con started.
And I don't know if it's cool to be this, but there is an official fan club for this movie called Insight. The International Network of Somewhere in Time Enthusiasts. That's not a joke, guys. Go to somewhereintime.tv. It be there.
Yeah.
It be there.
What kinds of things do these people do, Justin?
They go once a year to the Grand Hotel.
Featured heavily in the movie.
In Michigan. They go to the location this movie was almost entirely shot.
Right.
And there is, while Christopher Plummer was still alive, I don't know if he ever stopped by, but there's cast and crew that were involved.
Yeah.
Jane Seymour has come. She in 2019. They probably didn't do anything last year, right? Because of COVID.
Yep.
2020 was probably a sad year for many reasons, but for these folks, they couldn't.
They took a year off and they just tossed and turned in bed.
Yeah.
Just trying to get back.
Kind of.
That's what they did last year.
And they woke up sweaty this year and were like,
so sweaty.
Time to go back.
Yep.
So there's hundreds of these folks.
Yeah.
Like in 1992, I found an article in the Chicago Tribune from 1992.
Right.
And it was called Somewhere in Time Travelers by Charles Stroke.
And I know that guy.
Mr. Stroke talks about how like 800 of these folks descended on the Grand Hotel. This is 12 years after the movie came out.
That is shocking.
Right? So that doesn't exist for movies then. And
no.
Rarely now, unless it is some huge tentpole.
Star Wars or something.
Star Wars and Marvel, right? And DC stuff.
Right.
But other than that.
And like cult stuff like Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, sure.
But this is seemingly not that kind of movie.
So, no.
Yeah.
But it has a real following.
Yeah.
You can go to somewhereintime.tv and buy earrings and pendants and you can buy DVDs of their events in case you weren't able to be there in person at the Grand Hotel.
Oh my gosh.
It's really, so this is a real thing. People love this movie.
Yeah.
And for all of the faults of this movie, I think I kind of get a glimpse of it. Like,
okay.
I'm not one of those people that like, unfortunately, you know, actually, I do really want to be there, but I don't think I'll be able to go to the Grand Hotel this year.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because we won't be able to afford to go together.
You're going
to
be at the Rocky Horror Picture Convention instead.
With Gone with the Wind.
Of course.
That's
a fan club that wouldn't do well these days. Yeah.
Anyway, so we just point that out to show like this isn't, you know, typically if there's like bad movies or even just average movies, they just go and are forgotten about, or maybe they're minor cult status. Usually signifies, hey, yeah, like people that are movie nerds maybe like this movie and they go rent it and
You'll get like, even like we're looking at forward, maybe Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
You'd have a special screening on Groundhog Day.
Yep.
At a local theater.
Right.
People would show up with groundhog puppets and Bill Murray costumes. Like,
right.
But that's not like a society.
No. A society.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this movie does obviously work its magic, I guess, upon some people.
Right.
But we're not quite those people.
I don't think so.
But I will say in preface, I really expected to kind of vehemently hate this movie. There's a lot of questions I have at the end of this movie.
Oh yeah,
but it's not just a piece of trash.
It's not an easily hateable movie.
No, it still does have some kind of power, which I think is.
Yeah.
But it's not terribly hard to resist if you're thinking.
Yeah.
But everyone's different, and obviously the people that are a part of the society would disagree.
Beg to differ.
We are going to get the worst fan hate mail
in 1912 garb. They'd be like, "Good sir. How dare you?
I have a strong word for you, young man.
Let me get my pocket watch and tell you what time it is.
Very discourteous of you. Right. Anyway.
Let's learn some of the lessons that this movie has to say, Justin.
Oh, boy.
Get into the bones of it in Lessons in Lightspeed.
Well, I mean, wormholes, black holes, Tipler cylinders.
So not like fantasy, but science fiction.
Where are we going in your time machine?
Okay, now, we gotta set this thing to the 15th.
Do not lose that time device, or you will be stuck.
How will I know if it works?
You'll either know, or you won't.
So this movie is about our lead guy, Christopher Reeve, Justin.
Yep.
And he's a playwright.
Right.
And one thing that I'll give this movie credit for right off the bat is we're gonna see time devices, as we heard alluded to in the clip, but machines of some sort, right? We're also going to see a different structure of the time travel movie with like Groundhog Day's like the time loop kind of setup. In this case, I have questions about whether or not this is a time loop.
Yeah.
But more than anything, I did find it somewhat compelling and interesting that the time travel in this movie happens through a form of like self-hypnosis.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a, it's not
there's no machine.
It's not technology.
Nope.
It's a simple conversation between him and a former professor who says, oh, I did this for just the blink of a moment at one point.
Yeah.
Because I just convinced myself. I removed everything, modern from the room, and I just hypnotized myself into being in whatever time period.
Right.
So that's how we see it happen. He goes back in time because there's a woman at the beginning of the film who is old, who hands him a stopwatch, and she says,
come. Or it's just a regular watch. I said stopwatch earlier.
Oh, it's not a, it's a pocket watch.
Yeah.
It's a pocket watch.
They're all Olympic runners, so they love their stopwatches.
Yeah, there's medals everywhere. And the old lady says, come back to me. And
very Twilight Zone-y, right?
Very Twilight Zone-y. And he's like, what the heck? And then there's an eight-year jump, and then we're into the normal part of the story. And he goes back in time because he sees this painting, is entranced by this woman. The bulk of the movie is him in a romantic pursuit of this woman who he becomes infatuated with.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about the ending when we get there. Really, that's the plot.
Like,
there is a little antagonist action. Christopher Plummer plays her director because she's a stage actor.
Right.
And he's like, I'm not going to let you get romantically involved because you're going to be one of the greatest actors ever to live.
Right.
And he kind of is into her too.
Yeah.
That's made clear. So, Justin, how would you describe the feeling of this movie to someone? Because it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
Right. I think that's part of the magic, right? If you like it, right?
Okay.
It, for the people that are in that society, at least.
Yeah.
The feeling is one of just, I don't know, it's almost, it's dreamlike.
Yeah.
And it is, I think, akin to any young people that have been in love.
Sure.
It does kind of, there is some cinematic way this kind of captures, at least for my money, that feeling of just like that kind of obsessiveness when you're really falling in love,
the infatuation.
It's just like I have to have this, and it, like, the rest of life doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, it clearly doesn't matter for Reeve's character. You know, he just wants to get this woman no matter what. And so I think it's not a four trick pony. It's a one trick pony, right? So all you're doing, if you're there for that, it's because you really maybe through personal experience or, I don't know, unrequited love or whatever, maybe the viewer desires that. I don't really know what there's not a heck of a lot else to hold on to here. It's not incompetently shot, but it's just very serviceable.
Yeah.
Very working.
It is trying at times. Like, you have to talk about aesthetics because that's most of what the movie has, right? Is that, like, shooting for that hypnotic, dreamlike feel. You know, I think you're right. And I think that's what's frustrating about it for me is this is all predicated on one event, basically. Like, he gets the stopwatch. He gets the pocket watch. 8 years later, he sees a painting of this woman who I think he vaguely realizes is the same woman, but it's not like that's the woman with the watch.
Right.
He more just has like an ethereal infatuation the moment he lays eyes on this painting. And one of the ways that this movie feels is freaking slow. Like, the story is paced slow, but also just moments and sequences take forever.
Yeah.
And part of that is because they have this obsession with utilizing this musical theme, right, that was written for the movie, right? And it just creeps in moments
when you're not expecting
when you
it.
Don't.
Oh, it's still following us.
Are you doing that?
No. Is that Ralph in the engineer booth?
I'm gonna fire that guy. As I was saying, the music just creeps in moments, and it's this literally like I looked up the soundtrack for this movie. The soundtrack is only 30 minutes long, which for a movie that's an hour and 40 or whatever this is, that doesn't make any sense, right? Unless they repeat over.
Oh, do they repeat it in this movie?
Over. They repeat, and it just kind of keeps coming back, and it never... And it's kind of overwhelming. When other things are happening, it... Yeah. And the music is at the forefront, let's say.
It's one of the stars.
It's one of the stars of the film. It's a character in the movie itself, right?
It certainly is.
It is a plot device, too, because it's like there's a weird thing that happens where when they do the 8-year jump cut, it goes from that music because the old lady basically says, like, I've given him the watch. I've done my deed. Now I can die. They cut to him 8 years in the future, and he's listening to that song on a record player, and he, like, stops it.
Yeah.
So there's a weird Twilight Zone element to that could be interesting.
Right.
Except for that, it just kind of keeps coming
just
back.
When you don't expect it. And then you eventually want it to go away.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
No, it just keeps coming.
It's not that it's an unpleasant theme at all.
It's fine. What? Is this the first time you've seen this? It's a great... question to ask before, but I forgot.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I distinctly only remember the end of this movie.
Distinctly, but incorrectly, correct?
Distinctly, but incorrectly.
Yeah.
So our friend has Richard Collier, as played by Chris Reeve, goes back in time without Huey Lewis and without any trappings of
that
the
modern
age. That
was his real mistake, was not taking Huey Lewis in the news.
If he took the news back with him, I feel like he would have been popping at those parties.
He would have been just bouncing around.
Can you imagine like the Dixieland kind of Huey Lewis in the news version? That'd be awesome. Anyway, so he goes back without any trappings or remembrances of the modern age.
Or so he thinks.
He beat me to it. So at the end, when he's, you know, finally fallen in love and everyone is like, sweet, we're in 1912. This is freaking happening. I feel like we don't even need dragons. That's where their arrogance got them.
Yeah.
Right?
Idiots.
You need dragons.
You need them.
So Reeve reaches in his pocket and he pulls out a penny. He's like, look at my cool pocket. You know, I've got some things in here.
He says, I can keep things in my pockets. I can put things in them and things. And then he pulls out the penny and you're like.
And he looks at the date. And so at first it's just like, okay, he pulled a penny out. Then the score. Does the score help us understand what's going on there, Travis?
The score isn't the usual, you know, beautiful, sweet, sweeping theme. In this case, it's just like a...
It's nuts. It's Hans Zimmer.
It's
horn noise before Hans Zimmer did horn noise and then everyone copied him.
Yeah.
So he sees a penny from, you know, 1970 something.
79.
Right, 79. And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, it really does. It goes from like being slow, soft focus, you know, stuff that kind of sounds and feels. Oh my gosh.
Ralph, we can't take much.
Ralph.
This. Can you please, Ralph, just save it? Ralph. You can do it at the end, okay?
Ralph really likes the music.
Ralph is part of the society. But I didn't quite answer your question, I guess. So I remembered the ending. I remembered him pulling out the penny.
Coming down a staircase or something?
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
Okay, this is not what... What I remember is that Christopher Reeve is going down a spiral staircase in the Grand Hotel, and he pulls out a coin because he's like trying to get his watch or something. Uh-huh. And he's like, what's this? And then he sees it, and he just like kind of falls into the modern age, right?
Yeah.
And then I remember him in the modern age like being despondent.
Yeah.
But then I remember like people finding him in his bed, and it just gets like intense for a minute.
Uh-huh.
And like the paramedics are there.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you know, like we got to administer oxygen or whatever. Right. So I had this kind of more brutal memory of what it was. And in reality...
He gets sucked through a wormhole.
Right. And it's
the mechanics of the time travel, honestly, where I gave it credit at the beginning, because it's like, oh, it's kind of interesting. He has to hypnotize himself and then he enters 1912. That all ends up not really mattering, right? Because the penny just serves as the plot device for the machine to break down or for for H. George Wells to have to jump back in the machine because there's, you know, whatever. And I think what the movie fails for me is in its main conceit, right? Like, this is supposed to be a love story where he's sort of pursuing this woman who doesn't know him, but yet they lay breadcrumbs as if she sort of does. And this is where most of the frustrating questions happen, right? Okay.
Yes.
Let's start with the first one.
Where did the watch come from?
Yeah. So this movie posits the idea, like butterfly effect sort of consequences for time travel decisions, except it's paradoxical, again, like self-fulfilling prophecy, infinite loop problems. Like, yeah. She comes up to him with the watch 8 years before he does anything. She's old. She has the watch. Okay, 8 years later, he sees the painting, he becomes infatuated, and he decides, oh, if this is possible, I'm going to go back in time and find this woman. As part of that, he finds an address book, right? Or like a guest book.
Yeah.
Signing in for the play that she's in 1912. Oh my gosh, my name's in the playbook. I was there, right? So these things make sense if he has already gone back in time.
Right.
He has not yet.
Right.
Then he does, and he puts his name in the address book. He brings the watch. He has the watch with him.
Right.
When he goes back in time.
Because she gave it to him.
Because she gave it to him, and then he gives it to her when he goes back in time.
But she had already had it because he had already been there.
Right.
Except he hadn't gone yet.
But he was going to go.
But he was going to go.
And then come back, and she was going to give it to him after he had given it to her.
If you're confused, I think you should be.
Yeah, so there's that. The loop issues are the most frustrating thing.
Absolutely.
And it why is this frustrating from an adaptation standpoint, Justin?
Because Richard wrote the novel,
yeah.
And none of our biggest issues with this, pacing is one thing, you know, or like slow kisses.
Slow, yeah.
Whatever. We can live with that. What we can't live with is these weird paradoxes that don't exist in the novel.
Right.
In the novel, Richard has a brain tumor that he knows he's dying of. And
again, so, Twilight Zone-y.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so there is ambiguity about, like, is he just hallucinating this? Is this a side effect of the tumor? Or, like, what? And so that resolves any of this issue. Like, is this even possible? That I think that's a lot more layered and interesting kind of a take, you know, where you could really make an argument.
Sure.
Like, but there's no argument. He time travels in this movie.
Yeah, he doesn't have a brain tumor.
No. And so when he goes back, what are some of the other weird differences in the novel? He goes back. In the movie, she says when she meets him, they look at each other.
Right.
And it's like, okay, is this going to be really weird? Because the dude just popped out of the woods and is like looking at you.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's plenty of weirdness in that department, in my opinion.
Right. But then it's kind of, at least in the movie, it's kind of, you know, they subvert that by, she goes, is it you?
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay, maybe there's still hope for the watch,
right.
You know, or whatever. But what actually happens is that later in the movie, they just say, oh, no, it's actually nothing. She didn't imagine he would come. Her manager just told her, a dude's going to fall in love with you one day.
Like, yeah.
What?
Are you the guy who was foretold to me by my director?
But in the novel, supposedly there's a few psychics that tell her, like, this guy is going to come back.
Yeah, something more ethereal that they could
something
get away
more
with.
More Twilight Zone-y.
Yeah, it's full of frustrating things like that, and I don't think it's interested at all in tying up loose ends in the mechanics of time travel department. It's so much more obsessed with, these two people are meant to be together.
Yeah.
There's, again, like, I wrote down so many times that there was excruciatingly slow moments in this movie, right? Like,
what's your favorite one?
Well, when he walks toward the painting initially, that takes about a minute and a half. And when he goes in for the kiss, you get that.
Oh, yeah.
Get the score.
Oh, yeah. Again. Turn it up all the way. Come on, Ralph. Give us some more juice.
And he does a lot of face touching before he kisses her, and it's just
cradling the cheeks
so
and the
much
chin.
And then he just like starts to go in
and she tilts her head up.
I couldn't actually contain myself.
Yes, there was a tribal yell.
I screamed.
I thought that Rome was being overrun by the Gauls.
I was like, just do it. Like, I couldn't. I it was too much for me.
It was clearly too much.
And that doesn't end there, right?
No, it doesn't, because he goes back to his own time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's many instances of this in the movie. But he goes back to his own time, and I think one of the most egregious examples is when he's so forlorn, he can't be with his baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to the painting again and touches it. Just want to go back.
He just hugs. He hugs a two-dimensional painting.
No.
Yeah. So that's a bad moment.
It's so not good.
Yeah. Other things in this movie that happen between them also take a long time. When he goes in for the ultimate romantic gesture, should we say? It's like they don't really show anything.
Right.
It's sort of like Bond editing, you know, in a way. But they kiss or whatever, and then they just like cut to them, and he's just like no shirt, and he just like slowly
descends upon her.
It's like it's really not. It's.
I'm coming for you.
It's bad.
I love you.
Yeah. Anyway,
we are in love.
It's bad. Okay. So the story itself is so thin that if this, like you were saying, the enchanting part of it didn't really enchant me, and I think it's because I can't buy that a guy fell in love with a painting. Like I know that's an oddball thing to say.
Yeah. Because if you get rid of the brain tumor thing, it's like, yeah, that's going to be affecting your neurological processes. So I could totally buy if there's something there. You know, and we get breadcrumbs, don't we, in the beginning of this movie, even where like he can't write his play.
Yes.
He's broke up with his girlfriend.
Yes.
But those aren't examined.
And if he's dying.
Right.
And he thinks I'm going to die. And then he sees the painting and he's like, oh, I'm going to die. And I have to, this is the beautiful woman that I'm going to be like, with or something.
Yes. Yeah.
There's no stakes there to drive this. So he really just like sees a painting, falls in love with this person.
Hubba hubba.
And then for that reason, for me, there's just a creepy like Christopher Reeve stalking a painting woman through time vibe to all this. Like he is so immediately like he's just...
Yeah. He's I just, must have her.
He must have her. Yeah. Yeah. And that's his character, which we're supposed to be cool with and just be like, oh, it's beautiful. It's lovely. They love each other. Also, Christopher Plummer's character is like, you know, he makes it clear in their really dramatic standoff scene in the gazebo. Right? Yeah.
Before the brigands take Christopher Reeve away.
Where they have this conversation where he's like, don't you understand? Can you even see that my infatuation with this woman is not simply physical or romantic, but she's going to be one of the greatest actors of all time.
I'm
going to
make you a star.
Yeah. And then it's funny because there's this incredibly fast, jarring turn in that moment where he's like, he tells Christopher Reeve, I'm not just into her because she's pretty.
Right.
I love her because she's a great actor and I'm trying to groom her as an actor. And Christopher Reeve goes, oh, well, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
I owe you an apology.
Yes.
He says it with this inflection. I owe you an apology.
Yeah, and then 2 seconds later, the worst line delivery of the movie, which I'm going to give Christopher Reeve credit in a moment.
Okay.
This is, if you just go back and find this scene of them in the gazebo, he says this line, he says, you really think you own her, don't you? It's like the most insanely stiff, and it just came right after Christopher Plummer's like explaining like, I'm not really just physically infatuated with her. He also includes, by the way, that the first time he laid eyes on her, she was 16. So
Oops.
That's gross.
Oops.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that like undertones of just like this woman is a thing to be utterly worshipped in this movie.
Yeah.
So I guess like you said, if it's low hanging fruit for genre lovers of like melodramatic,
nostalgic, just
then this might do it for you. But for me, I just like, I'm like, oh, it's a lot of that. It's slathered on thickly.
Very thick. And so I think some of those problems. Oh, and one more problem I just remembered from the novel.
Yes.
Or that doesn't exist in the novel. It's in the movie.
Yeah.
The pocket watch scene where she gives him the watch is not even in the novel.
So you don't have that problem of like, how did There's it get no there prob- before? No. Yeah. No. See, that's
so
a fix.
I don't know why they even, why those changes is kind of mystifying to me. It sounds like bad studio notes.
I would assume if he wrote the novel and then was adapting it, I mean, what you see a lot of times, like the most prolific examples are like Stephen King has often licensed his work. He's also adapted some of his own work into stuff and he goes more beat for beat with it when it's his, you know, because it's like, I thought this was good here. I thought it would be good there.
Right.
So I would think studio interference, maybe just for mystery's sake, you know what I mean? For like,
it's not good. The mystery is you just go, how does that happen?
Yeah. It's utterly annoying. So we have Christopher Plummer's evil Colonel Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
He tries
to dip Chris Reeve in fried chicken sauce
and he ties him up. He almost gets there.
He hog ties him
Yep.
and gags him.
Yep. and then he
leaves him in the horse barn.
Yeah, that's where the fried chicken is made
uh-huh.
in 1912.
Uh-huh.
I will say Christopher Reeve in this case, and I would probably say in other things too, although I yeah. haven't seen his entire filmography, like he is way committed in this movie. Like,
yes,
he's giving 8,000%. Like, 35% of this movie is him, like, alone in a room,
right,
in a 1912 suit.
Yeah,
although they make fun of it a lot. He's rolling around on a bed, just like, please, 1912, like trying to self hypnotize himself. And I can't imagine, Justin, with as much as that footage made it into the movie,
right?
How much of it ended up on the cutting room floor,
right?
He must have lost weight.
That dude, yeah,
burned calories doing this. Oh,
totally.
Stuff.
Well, look how sweaty he was.
And then when he comes back, the penny he gets sucked back into the 1980, he's covered. He's drenched in sweat.
Well, I guess the professor dude did let him know in the beginning. I was very tired. I was exhausted.
You know what?
I went back for just a moment.
We don't even... That is not a loose thread. They tied that one up beautifully. If he wasn't covered in sweat, that line would have made no sense.
Well done.
Oh, perfect movie. So that's the gist of the movie.
The gist of the movie, man.
There's one other thing that is kind of obnoxious to me that they do, because it's like... He really did travel. He's walking through the lobby of the hotel the first time, just like, look at the wardrobes. Well, you know what they had in 1912, Justin? They had hats.
They
had a lot of hats.
Everyone had a hat.
Yes. They also had Baby Arthur.
Baby Arthur. Excuse me, sir. Have we met before? I don't know why he sounds like Mary Poppins.
His name's Arthur. Arthur, but young. Yes. They do that like four times, right?
Yeah.
Where they like show Baby Arthur, because he says earlier, I was in the lobby of this hotel bouncing a ball when I was just a wee lad.
Yeah.
And then like they say, Arthur, come here. Arthur, get away from there. Arthur, not inside. Just to remind you, he really did do it, you guys. He's in 1912.
He really is there.
He's there. Okay. I think there's everything we talked about is the whole movie. It's just that it all takes 18 minutes every time something happens. So let's get into, Justin, the final wrap-up here, if we can.
Yeah.
Unless you have anything else you want to add.
I was just thinking that...
Well, Justin, let's try.
But yeah, let's try. I just want to get back.
Try to get... You got a penny on you?
No!
Let's get into our final section. Gosh, Ralph.
Okay,
geez.
We don't need more, Ralph. You got to do the other segment.
Our final.
Bring in the other music,
geez.
Ralph.
Jeez. Our final segment, which is called Past, Present, and Future Value.
Obviously, the time continuum has been disrupted, creating this new temporal event sequence resulting in this alternate reality.
English, Doc.
If you travel to the past, that past becomes your future. And your former present becomes the past, which can't now be changed by your new future.
Exactly. Gentlemen, we're history.
All right, Justin, kick it off, man. Does this thing have any past, present, or future?
Wow. I mean, it may not for me. Ralph, I'm trying to talk. I mean, it may not for me. But clearly this movie does affect people, right? Like, enough to be...
In ways.
Committed. Yes. Like, I think these people might be trying to go back to 1912, too.
Do you think there's a person in
that
who, like, puts on the suit and lays in that hotel room, and they're like...
I must get back to Gene Simmons. Oh, man. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. Hopefully those people are, you know, I would imagine by and large they just love the movie, but maybe there's some time travel involved too.
Right.
Maybe that's what they're doing. It's a secret society of time travelers. Did you consider that?
No.
Oh, okay. So
for you, man, what do you think?
Okay. Yeah, for me, I think there is value in watching this movie. First of all, I think this movie would be a lot better if they just kept to the novel.
Yeah.
And they took away about half an hour of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is
it's like an hour,
hour 45 almost.
Yeah, like an hour and 20 movie or something.
We'd be fine, I think. Yeah. I think the vast majority of these problems would be gone, and it'd be more trim in a good way. But, you know, as slow as this movie was, I kept being kind of weirded out that clearly other people are very bothered by that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I can't wait to watch this movie again,
no.
But I kept thinking, why does this not bother me more?
Okay.
So I think
it went down smooth for
there
you.
There is, yeah. I mean, long. It was a long draught. It was drinking like several yards.
It was a hose of the Somewhere in Time melodrama beer.
Yes. But, you know, overall, yeah, I think I can kind of, I'm never going to go to the Grand Hotel, alas, but unless Ralph wants to take me. But, you know, I do think I get a little glimpse of why this movie is so potent for some people. Okay. So, yeah, I think it's worth watching just to try to understand or just make it through as much as you can.
Yeah.
And just, you know, you can either see, like, you'll either find out clearly and quickly, I think, like, am I a person that, like, is made for this movie, you know, or vice versa.
So perhaps never.
Would I ever watch it again? I would watch it again with somebody. Like, my mother loves this movie.
Yeah.
She loves this movie. It's one of her favorites.
Before we recorded today, you saw your mom for a moment.
I did. She stopped by and I let her know we were going to be recording this. And she said, that's one of my favorites. I hope you don't have anything disparaging to say about it. And I said, no, Mom. I just have some questions.
This one's for you, Mom.
Love you, Mom. Okay. Yeah, so, you know,
it's not an easy answer for you on this
It's not.
Huh?
I wouldn't say absolutely never again, but I'm probably not going to seek it out necessarily. How about you?
I think we often like to play producer on this show, and just as people, like, we watch enough movies and love the ones we love and find reasons to hate the ones we hate, and I often find myself with a movie like this that is not, I would say, not really easy to hate. But there's nothing here for me, you know, like, as a viewer. How could I fix this? How can I make this better for someone like me? Or maybe just a mass audience, because this is not a mass audience movie today. I mean, it made plenty
Clearly not.
Yeah, it made plenty of money then, and, you know, it had...
Interestingly, though, in that Chicago Tribune
review
from 1992,
right,
when he's talking about these people getting together, he said it didn't really do well.
Yeah.
It wasn't like
profitable.
A hit success. Sure. Right. But it wasn't a runaway.
I think you're right. And it does have... It has that aesthetic of whenever you turn over a decade in film, which we're seeing a lot on this show, there's this like strong amount of like the early part of the decade. And this, I think, goes more for 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and aughts, like going forward, because film was still really getting its legs under it in the 30s and 40s, which we've covered. You have like tons of vestiges of the past decade.
Right.
And then you move into the next one.
I mean, because it's only 1980, so they probably shot some of it in 79.
That's what I'm saying. Like, so much of this feels like 70s television. Like, the gauzy, slow, like, melodrama feel of it is really a 70s feature.
Totally.
In a lot of ways.
Totally.
That aside, right, because it's just the nature of the beast for 1980 when the film was made. For me, there are things in this movie that I would love for there to be more of. There's comedy. Like, very, very kind of nicely peppered throughout very sparse moments. Mm-hmm. The stuff where she's on stage and she's, like, faking her lines. She goes off script because she's doing this crazy monologue right at him. And the guy who's supposed to be keeping track of the notes and her fellow actor on stage, they're all like, what do we do?
Right. There's
some great, like, nonverbal stuff that had us chuckling for a moment. There's a couple moments like that I'm like, if you balance out the story with a little bit more comic relief...
Yes.
And just re-edited it, right? To, like, not have, you know, this one song that just comes up over and over and over.
No, Ralph, they've heard the song. Turn it down, Ralph. Jeez. Dude.
If that didn't happen, like, a dozen times throughout the movie, I think there might be something here. If it was Twilight Zone-y length and whatever. But for me, there's not a lot of value here for me.
Sure.
I mean, like, the story doesn't have anything real to say.
Yeah.
It probably would if he had a brain tumor, you know? And I think that is a huge thing missing from this. This needs more tumors. At least one more. So I don't think I'll rewatch this because that just felt like a 4-hour watch to me. The kiss alone felt like a 90 minutes. would I recommend it to anybody? I don't know. I just don't even know, man.
I don't know. Because clearly some people are going to like this. So
someone, somewhere, somewhere in time.
Well, do we have anything else to say about this one, Travis?
I would love to move on, Justin, if we can. Somewhere in Time was an interesting experience. Definitely a time travel movie. A little bit rife with the problems that I think we might encounter in some future ones.
Absolutely.
Next week, we have a different kind of time travel movie.
We've got Groundhog Day.
Yes.
With Bill Murray.
Which is a time loop movie.
Yep.
This movie might be, that we watched this week, not sure. Groundhog Day, Definitely is.
Definitely is.
We got a new guest coming on for that episode. Should be fun.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you all then for Groundhog Day.
Bye.
Bye.
Let the movie speak.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.